Hello and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha, and this week I am not joined by my normal co-host Jordan Crook, but somewhat taking her place is John Schieber. Welcome, John.
Hi, Anthony. No one can actually take Jordan's place, but I'm here to do what I can, and y'all would be forgiven if you stopped listening to this podcast right now. But we will push on.
We sure will. So we're going to do a bunch of different things on this episode, most of them hopefully fairly quickly. We're going to talk about the Super Bowl, some news around the Super Bowl about the ads. We're going to talk about some news about Disney streaming service, and we're going to talk a little bit about our impressions of this new Netflix series, Russian Doll, but neither John nor I has seen the whole thing yet. So hopefully we'll do a more in-depth review sometime in the next few weeks. And then we're going to review Velvet Buzzsaw, which is a new Netflix film. I think it's safe to say that John and I both really, really liked it.
I don't want to spoil it for everyone, but I have some choice words about Velvet Buzzsaw.
One choice word in particular.
Well, several. I will say that I think that of the movies with Velvet in their title, perhaps Velvet Goldmine is a better way to spend one's time. But we'll get there. Why don't we start off, Anthony, with a little bit of a talk about the Super Bowl, or as I call it, the game that should not have been, with the halftime show that should also not have been. To kick it off, I think the numbers for streaming of the Super Bowl were pretty impressive and kind of point to a tipping point, do they not?
Well, I mean, I think ish. I mean, that they've certainly grown. If you add in the streaming numbers, it had a combined total of 100.7 million viewers, which and that's like a sort of a new high as far as the amount of streaming. But I think the average live TV audience was 98.2 million. So, I mean, obviously the vast majority. In fact, I can do the incredibly complicated math and say roughly 98% of the audience was watching it live. But it's growing. It's certainly changing. And that, the Super Bowl is interesting because it's the event that, you know, when people talk about cord cutting and also I think this related trend of, you know, you don't need to watch anything live and then everything you watch is time shifted. They talk about sports in particular is the one thing that's the holdout from that. And then within sports, it's the Super Bowl. This is like the one event where you can still get an enormous audience to watch live.
Right.
And that is still obviously true. I mean, there's literally nothing on television, at least among US viewers, that gets that level of audience. Right. But that number is also declining a little bit, especially when you just look at the live TV numbers.
Yeah, and especially when you have a game that was as terrible. I didn't even watch it out of protest. I'm a Saints fan, and my Saints should have been playing in that game, and it would have been a much better game. But yeah, setting aside the bad officiating of the NFL, that game was, from what I understand, a snooze fest, and it really should have just been Outkast that did the halftime show rather than Maroon 5, which makes Imagine Dragons look like an amazing band.
I did watch it. I mean, this is the one football game of the year that I will grudgingly watch. I'm anti-football in the fact that I think, like, you know, in very well documented ways, professional football and the NFL are not great organizations. I also just think football is kind of boring to watch.
Yeah.
Or it's like there's like 10 minutes of entertaining stuff happening, and then the rest of it is like the ball, you know, these right. like incomplete plays and just like the ball kind of nudging forward or backwards.
I get it, Anthony. You don't like the sports ball. You're not into the
I don't like specifically the football. I mean, I'm not a big sports fan in general, but I like watching tennis. I don't do a ton of it, but that's actually something I enjoy watching. Football is great when it's great, and there's a lot of times when I don't think it was. Anyway, the game I thought was not amazing, so I can understand if, you know, I think maybe people weren't interested in necessarily watching the entirety of this game that was really kind of a slog. The main reason I watch is just to see the commercials.
Right. What were the commercials any good? Did you? I know that you wrapped up all of them. Were there any particular highlights?
So, I mean, we focused, as you would expect, on the ones that were either from tech companies or featured tech in some way. And I would say there was nothing that I thought was, like, amazing this year. I think the Amazon Alexa ad was, like, really fun to watch. This, did you see this? This is the one with Harrison Ford and...
I saw them tease it where Harrison Ford basically said he's not impressed, which is how I feel about most of these like Alexa enabled gadgets anyway.
Right.
But it was nice to hear them voiced by Han Solo. My criticism and Han Solo's criticism align, which, you know, how often do I get to say that?
It is a little, the ad is a little confusing because you don't actually, it's all the things that they're like, oh, we won't add Alexa to because it would be stupid, like a toothbrush, right, which is fine. But like, in terms of convincing me that I should get, you know.
Didn't they do a freaking microwave? Isn't there an Alexa microwave?
Right. I think in part, they're sort of acknowledging the conversation around that.
Yeah. It's a little absurd. Also, I don't need a voice activated lamp, I don't think, from a company like Casper.
I slept for several days with the Casper lamp. It's not voice activated. It's gesture controlled. And I mean, you don't need it. I mean, it's true. The bar is like, you absolutely need it. No, but did it help me sleep? It genuinely helped me sleep because of the way it like dims and the quality of the light. Actually, I highly recommend it. I'm going to buy one for myself. And so I actually think it's good. I mean, the gesture stuff I think is overstated. That's really not the cool thing. The cool thing is just that it like is a light that makes it easier to sleep.
But we digress. We are moving away
really
from
need. Yes.
Into the world of hardware, which we should not do. That someone else is doing.
Listen, we go where we want. But so I think what people have commented on in terms of the themes on the advertising is that there were multiple commercials, including one from Michelob and one from Pringles, where these like assistants or robots, I think the way Quartz put it was like, this is the year of the sad robot.
Right.
And they're like, you know, that there's this sense of that these things are now pervasive enough. I mean, they're kind of different. I mean, one is basically just a generic, you know, parody of right. Alexa. One is like a science fictional giant robot. Or actually, there are a couple right. of those. There's one in the Intuit TurboTax ad too. But they're kind of different. But it's weird to see this sort of confluence of all these different, you know, fictional forms of artificial intelligence and robotics appearing in the ads in 1 year. So it sort of suggests that there's maybe something in the air culturally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, since last year was the year of the sad human, I'm much more more inclined to have this year be the year of the sad robot. 2018 was such a dumpster fire. If we're now like sort of outsourcing that to our robotic soon to be overlords, I'm completely fine with that. I'd rather they be sad than you. Just saying.
Well, I think the problem is, what if the robot's sad and we're sad and that's just, you know, everything's sad.
Then everything is miserable. But there is one bright spot on the horizon, at least for me, one thing that I'm kind of excited about, and that's actually the Disney streaming service, which is weird for me to say, but and that was a terrible segue, but I'm going to do it anyway.
It was a little rocky, but we're just going to charge through.
Let's just move right through it. That streaming service from Disney keeps looking more and more interesting to me, and more compelling as an option, especially as they open it up to content or intellectual property stories that are coming from outside of the house, as it were.
So Sarah Perez wrote this article about Disney Plus, basically. This was part of like Disney's earnings announcement, which was kind of quiet this year. I mean, this quarter, there wasn't a lot of tech related stuff, but they did, because I think there was a little bit, at least from my perspective, this feeling of they're still waiting to actually launch Disney Plus, and they're kind of getting all their ducks in a row for that. But one of the things they did mention is the fact that, as you said, they're going to be licensing shows from sources outside of Disney. Although I have to say, when I first heard this, I thought it meant like they were going to be kind of like Netflix, where you could go in and, you know, you'll see Netflix originals, but then you'll see a bunch of shows that you've watched elsewhere, whether that's Friends or Star Trek or whatever. And I get the sense that actually kind of what they mean is more like that there'll be shows. So they talk about the show Diary of a Female President from one of the writers of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And that's not a show that, exists anywhere else. It's still like, right, a quote unquote Disney Plus original. I don't know if that's the terminology they're going to use, but,
right,
you know, it's still going to be premiering on this service. It's just going to be created by another studio rather than by Disney itself. So they're going to non-Disney sources for some of this content, but, mm-hmm, but I think, again, this could change. I mean, and the strategy, I think, in some ways, is probably still evolving. But that you're still probably going to go to Disney Plus for this Disney library of content, whether that's movies, Marvel movies, Star Wars movies, and so on. And then for new content that they're commissioning, whether it's made by Disney or someone else, it's not going to be exactly the same value proposition that you get from like a Netflix.
Right. It that's the way it seems to me too, but just the fact that they're opening it up is better. I don't think that anyone, well, I can't really say that for sure, but it's definitely a better value proposition for viewers if they're not just getting, you know, the latest Star Wars, Marvel, and Darkwing Duck or Scrooge McDuck DuckTales content. And are actually getting a broader sort of array of shows. Although I am a super nerd and I would in fact pay money just for the Marvel stuff and the Star Wars stuff. It's nice to see that they're opening up the IP portfolio to new things as well. I don't know.
I think there's obviously been a lot of conversation recently about, you know, just this incredible hunger for content that Hollywood has now that's been created by Netflix and then everyone else trying to figure out their own Netflix style service.
Right.
And so this is like another indication that like that Disney Plus is going to be this, you know, is going to be in some ways just as hungry for content as everyone else. And so I don't think you're going to see, and I don't think anyone really wants to make as many shows and movies as Netflix does, but
right,
that they're also acknowledging that just having, like you were saying, you know, a big Star Wars show is not going to be enough to get people to subscribe in the long term. And so they're going to explore like a range of strategies to actually flesh out that content.
Well, but I mean, you say that no one wants to produce as much as Netflix, but Amazon went on that huge buying spree at Sundance this year, right? And picked up a number of movies and I think they spent the most money of any studio or house or distribution platform at Sundance this year, really just hoovering up content.
That's true. And I mean, so I think they're definitely going to ramp up, but I think like, and again, I haven't actually counted. So if somebody actually does the math and it turns out I'm completely full of shit, I will apologize. But my sense anecdotally is that, yes, that they're being like a very aggressive studio and again, a home for, I think, some of these movies that probably might not do as well as like a sort of traditional independent theatrical release, which is great. But that's still like on another level from like Netflix, when Netflix is really going and like there's, right, 10 new shows and movies every week, where, you know, there's this sense of it's physically impossible to keep up with what Netflix is putting out versus with, you know, oh, if you bought a bunch of Sundance movies, that's, you know, a very aggressive strategy. And partly I think because Amazon has sort of been a little quiet for the past year because there've been some executive changes over there. But yeah, not to say that other people aren't in that game and aren't trying to have that level of volume. I just think Netflix, at least for now, is really kind of in a league of its own in terms of how much it's putting out there.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I mean, we were talking about this before we jumped on the podcast, but the number of shows that Netflix put out just this week alone that we could review or could watch is pretty impressive. There were, I think, like three or four new Netflix originals, two of which looked really interesting, one of which might have been an extreme disappointment, but you know, only time and the rest of this podcast will tell which shows we are talking about and which ones we aren't.
Right. I'm just looking at the right now the Netflix they have this like press website where they list all their new stuff, and like basically at the beginning of February they released a show called Always a Witch, a movie called Dear X, and then Russian Doll and Velvet Buzzsaw, which we're gonna talk about, and then something called Romance is a Bonus Book, which is a series. And yeah, and like, you know, I have no idea what a lot, and then, you know, I cast every week. And that doesn't get to what they're actually releasing this week, including, I think, that as you mentioned, the Steven Soderbergh film, High Flying Bird, which I'm definitely interested in. There's a Hasan Minhaj special coming, series coming out in 2 days. It's out of control. Yeah. But, you know, they seem to think it's working for them.
Listen, a full employment act for writers is I'm all about it. The more the more money Netflix wants to pay to creative folks who are writing new shows, the better. I'm all for it. Spend that money. Spend that shareholder money, Netflix.
That's right. Well, let's talk about two of those new things then. First up is this show Russian Doll, which is stars Natasha Lyonne as this woman who basically at the end of every night dies and then is sent and basically is reliving the night of her 36th birthday over and over.
She gets further and further along, right? So as the series progresses, I think she manages to last a little bit longer. So it's not quite Groundhog Day, where if things don't get done correctly, the day repeats, whether or not it's not necessarily the same day. It can be whatever period or whatever duration until she dies. And then she gets reset to the night of her birthday, right?
Yeah, exactly. The exact duration is fuzzy. It's not like in Groundhog Day, there's like a very sort of a couple memorable scenes where he's like looking at the clock. And when the clock strikes midnight, he knows everything gets reset, and it's fuzzier, right, in a way that I think I was watching it with my roommate, and I really like this. I've seen three episodes so far. And it's kind of hard to talk about because I do feel like this is one of those series where it's really telling one story. So I've only, you know, essentially, you know, read through or experienced, you know, 3/8 of the full story, but I think it's really good. I think my roommate is having a little bit of trouble with it because he feels like the rules of the repeating are kind of fuzzy and they don't necessarily make sense to him yet.
I think with repeated watching, it becomes a little bit clearer. And I also, it's great to have a show that makes you work a little bit to get a sense of the universe and where you are in it or where the other character is in it, or the characters. But I really love, I mean, like, Natasha Lyonne is hilarious. It's an incredibly funny show. There's a lot of it that, well, since I moved from New York, just seeing all of those places was really sort of wonderful and made me think back to all of my misspent days in Alphabet City, which is where the majority of the show takes place, it seems. And I also appreciated, this is like a small note, but I think one that's always worth pointing out, it's pretty geographically consistent, it seems, in that it doesn't like jump around that much from the Alphabet City neighborhood to like the Upper East Side or the Upper West Side and create some sort of weird, insane New York geography where two very different neighborhoods exist sort of right next to each other. It seems actually pretty realistically geographically constrained, which is a small and nerdy point, but one that I appreciate.
No, I've definitely noticed that with other things, like for example, the Marvel Netflix shows, which I mean, I think are varying in quality, but a sort of common tactic is that they'll definitely shoot in various locations around New York, whatever locations work for them for a specific scene. And then they'll say, oh, okay, like this is all Harlem or this is all Hell's Kitchen. And you'll be like, that looks like you shot that like next to my apartment in Brooklyn. I don't think that's Harlem.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of it you can be forgiven because they have to do what they have to do. But in creating this sort of weird alternate universe or this reality, they've done a really good job, I think, of making it real. like there's still a lot to be determined about why it is in fact that this woman is repeating, is sort of forced to confront her life repeatedly from this, her like 36th birthday. But it's really great. I mean, it's funny. It's very depressing. The characters are pretty well realized. They seem sort of a little comically overdone, but in a way that is relatable. Those instances in the show are things that have happened to people who live in New York. Maybe not the dying and then reliving the same day, but like being in a bodega and having like drunk assholes, you know, be drunk assholes, or going to some crazy house party. And I recognize all of the neighborhood, and it just sort of resonated. I like it a lot, is what I'm trying to say.
I felt similar in that. I mean, I have not lived in Alphabet City or the East Village, but I mean, I've spent a lot of time there because the TechCrunch New York office is close by. And I think the other thing that for me, though, even more than that, was just, you know, having this character who is celebrating her 36th birthday. And I also recently turned 36. And there's this sort of interesting feeling of, or maybe at least interesting to me, maybe not to other people, of like, you know, sort of being on like the cusp of like, where you are still young enough that you are conceivably going to like crazy parties, and not that I really am, and like making terrible decisions, but also there's this kind of feeling of exhaustion of kind of like, ugh, I'm too old for this shit. And I think they capture that really well. And that's both for comedic effects, but also for this sort of broader sense of like, okay, well, if like I've sort of had my kind of hopefully kind of crazy 20s and early 30s, like what comes next? Like, what do I want my life to be now? And I think that is part of what the show is about. I think it ends up being about a lot of different things, but that's part of, I think, what's driving the character.
Right. No, I definitely agree with that. It's there is more to it. Right. And I mean, but it is trying to find your place in a pre-midlife crisis, sort of midlife crisis, when the notion of adulthood and I think childhood or like being a kid and playing has been extended, right? So people are sort of acting like are acting out their 20s, like well into their 30s, or in my cases, sometimes into your 40s. But we won't go there. definitely. I think that's a big part of the show. And I think it's a big part of what resonates. And you think about it more demographically, like people still like to talk about millennials as if millennials aren't buying homes and having children right now, you know, but like the oldest millennials are, you know, in their 30s and doing this stuff.
Right. Technically, I think depending on what definition you use, I'm like a year or two away from being like the, you know, in the oldest cohort of millennials. But I am an old millennial. And it is funny sometimes when people are clearly in their heads envisioning this young, sprightly 18-year-old when they talk about that. But yeah, I highly recommend Russian Doll. I'm looking forward to maybe talking about it some more when we finished it. Two things I would say really quickly about it. One is, I'm somebody who likes to, I mean, I think in general, I'm somebody who kind of likes to like cheat and spoil themselves a little, but, one like relatively guilt-free way I do that is just by reading episode descriptions. Don't do that for Russian Doll, because there's a specific twist that kind of comes towards the end of the first few episodes that's basically spoiled by the episode descriptions. So don't read the episode descriptions if you can help it. I would also say, the show is created by Natasha Lyonne and Amy Poehler, and then Leslie Headland, who has directed two films that I highly, highly recommend. One is called Sleeping with Other People, and that is Jason Sudeikis and
That was a great movie.
That's a really fun, like, in some, you know, like it's a romantic comedy, and it sort of follows the rules of that in some ways, but it is just really wonderfully written, and you just really get to know the characters. And there are a few moments in it that I found like genuinely moving. And then she also made this movie Bachelorette, which I absolutely love. I just think is amazing, and is just this very, very funny, very, very kind of mean comedy about, again, some of the same stuff of, like, you know, get moving into your 30s, getting married, hating everyone, and it's good. I highly recommend it. So if you like Russian Doll, check out Bachelorette especially, and also Sleeping with Other People if you haven't seen it.
Yeah. And I like strong recommend for Russian Doll. It's really, really good. It's a lot of fun. What isn't a lot of fun is Velvet Buzzsaw, which, my God, I don't know that I could say enough bad things about that movie and the hour and 29 minutes I spent watching it.
Well, so let's start by trying to explain the plot of this film. First of all, I'm just looking at the cast list here. So Jake Gyllenhaal plays a character named Morph Vandervault,
yes. Which, yes, I he does.
The writer and director Dan Gilroy thought was funny. And I guess it kind of is funny, but it not really. So Morph, and a lot of people say his name a lot in the movie. So there's a lot of people like, right. Morph, where's Morph? And they had to keep a straight face. But so Morph is this very influential art critic. Rene Russo plays Redore Hayes, who owns this art gallery. And basically what happens in the film is that another character played by, I think, Zawe Ashton is how you pronounce her name. She discovers these paintings by this by one of her neighbors who is old and dies, and decides that she's going to claim, you know, basically that she represents this artist and that she just found these paintings, and they're these like sort of vivid outsider art, you know, sketches and it's sort of hard to sort
and
of
paintings
hard to
and drawings, yeah,
yeah, and then basically as this stuff kind of makes its way out into the world and gets more and more publicity, it also comes out that this artist was very disturbed, and he left instructions that all his art should be destroyed. So, his ghost is, or some form, is very unhappy about what's happening to his art, and people involved in the distribution or publicizing of his art start to disappear and to die. And so it's this weird mix of trying to be like a satire of the art world while also being like a slasher horror movie.
Yeah. None of it landed. None of it landed. Like, everything about it was sort of tonally off. The scares weren't scary. The satire wasn't satirical. The caricatures of these sort of people are supposed to embody within the art world are not even like well done caricatures. It was really, really bad. Like, I'm in awe at how great the cast is and how terrible the movie is that came out of this. But I mean, I guess that's what happens sometimes. it's not like the art world isn't an easy target, right? I mean, it's an incredibly easy target, but they just did it in such a ham-handed way that was trying to be very intellectually challenging, and they're trying to get at some of the hypocrisies and ridiculousness of the art world. And some of the tropes sort of line up, right? Like, artists are always putting their blood, sweat, and tears into their work. And in this case, this artist literally put, apparently, his blood into his work, which is what I think imbued the paintings with this haunted and haunting quality. And they're mining his biography and the tragedies of his life for both his work and then to profit off of it and create this kind of narrative around this clearly disturbed artist. But the art wasn't that good. that that he, the paintings themselves that are supposed to be imbued with this genius weren't that great. And on top of that, the everything about it was just really not well done.
Well, talk about the target, you know, the art world satire in particular. So the writer director Dan Gilroy, he I think before this was mostly known for this movie Nightcrawler, which also starred Jake Gyllenhaal, and he also made this movie Roman J. Israel Esquire, which I did not see, but there was a review that I thought made an interesting point that all of his movies, basically, at least all the movies that he's directed, there have been other movies he's written, seem to kind of go after these very obvious targets. Like Nightcrawler, which I think in a lot of ways is a very well-made movie, possibly the best performance Jake Gyllenhaal has ever done in a film. But when you think about it, there's an element of like, yes, he's basically telling you that TV news and ambulance chasing TV news is bad, and you're like, no shit. And Roman J. Israel kind of similarly, I think, sort of targets like predatory like lawyers, and then Velvet Buzzsaw again telling you that like the pretentious art world is pretentious and like hypocritical. It's not surprising, and so in like he kind of has to like, in order to try to make the satire work, he just has to try to make it as extreme as possible, at least in the two movies, in Nightcrawler and Velvet Buzzsaw, where he just has to make everyone like even more despicable than you thought. Like, you knew they were bad, but wow, no, they're really like bad people. And I don't know. I mean, there's times where I kind of found some of the inside baseball art world stuff kind of interesting. Like when there's like negotiations over, you know, with the museum about like how this show is going to like be set up. And so there's little touches like that, that I found interesting. And some of the stuff in the beginning where he's just walking around, you know, an expo of new art. And I mean, the way that everyone is sort of like afraid of him and impressed by him seemed a little like pretty over the
top. Yeah. But I don't think that that's all that real either. Right. There's some truth to it about you know, critics can make or break an artist, but really it's more the collectors and the rich people who are buying and selling this stuff, right? And some of it is about the gallerists themselves have already in many ways sort of made the artist before it even gets to a critic, and sort of the critic is there to either validate or sort of tear down. But at this point, like I just felt like it was a really superficial way of approaching something that could be done more, I don't want to say in a more nuanced fashion, because that doesn't necessarily need to happen. But it's not like you need to satirize all that much or caricature all that much what happens in the art world to make it resonant or funny or depressing or maudlin or any of that, because that shit already is there. It's there in the business, and it almost already is a caricature of itself in some ways. But like, I don't know. I love art, and I spend a lot of time going to art galleries and like looking at art. And nothing is as awfully pretentious as they made it out to be in one way. Like, I know that they're trying to make it over the top, or he was trying to make it over the top. But you can do that. I guess what I'm saying is that you can take a more straightforward approach, still have this sort of sinister element to it, still talk about the art world being sort of using people up and throwing them out, spitting them out, without sort of the need to be quite so heavy-handed. Or if you're going to be that heavy-handed, just go all in, right?
I agree that there's it's neither like, it doesn't feel realistic and believable, but it also doesn't feel crazy enough to be kind of interesting in a kind of hyperbolic way. And so
right.
you kind of get something that's kind of that's in between, essentially. And I mean, I think there were a few moments when I was amused, but certainly no moments when I laughed out loud. And I think similarly on the horror side, there are a few moments where it's, you know, somebody walking into a dark room and like, you know, weird stuff starts to happen and you get a little right. bit of tension, but I was never genuinely frightened. And
no, I mean, there's no jump scares in this. Like The Haunting of Hill House for a few episodes was like truly terrifying. There was scary stuff in that series, and Netflix can definitely do horror well when they want to. This was neither scary nor particularly acerbic. It was just sort of execrable. I got it in.
We spent like 10 minutes before we started recording this episode just debating the pronunciation, but I think you nailed it.
I think I did. I think I'd give myself an 8 out of 10 on the dismount for execrable, which is a funny word to say and hear. But definitely fits with this movie.
What did you think of Gyllenhaal's performance?
Well, I mean, there were also a lot of issues, I think, with like representation in that movie too, or like the effete bisexual art critic as a character was like, it was something. And I know that Gyllen, but wasn't he a sort of similar character in the other movie he did with this guy, Nightcrawler? Wasn't he also kind of a creepy?
He was creepy in a different way that, in Nightcrawler, he basically becomes like the villain and the monster. And I can't remember if he like expressed any sexuality at all. If he did, it wasn't a major part of his characterization. So there were similarly sort of like over the top intense performances. This goes into this much more, like you were saying, kind of like I don't think he's doing exactly a, you know, sort of not entirely the sort of stereotypical, you know, feminine gay character, but there's elements of that. And he's like, playing him as this very, it's still kind of a feat in as a feat as you can be when you're also like really, really jacked the way Jake Gyllenhaal is, and as you get to see in the film. He's like this very like pretentious, pompous character. Actually, there is like one moment where he goes to a funeral and is just like very dismissive of the organ music in the funeral, which was like really dumb. But I also enjoyed. And so there are a few moments like that where I enjoy just sort of how mean the character can be. But it seemed like he was that Gyllenhaal was like working really hard, maybe having a good time, but like it wasn't working.
Right. No, the lack of chemistry among all of the people in the movie was pretty apparent to me. I thought, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal is a compelling actor just in general, right? And he's just sort of compelling. He has a presence and he's good when he's good. It's just that this particular role was in some ways like just a bit too empty. And delivering snide lines about an artist. There was another scene where he's in a gallery and he's talking about this artist's work, and two women are sort of dismissing him for being too cruel, and they cause this artist to get, you know, drunk and get into an accident, and he was in a coma, and Gyllenhaal was like dismissive of everything and saying, sort of denying responsibility. And some of that was clever, I guess, but none of it really landed. And none of it seemed, again, I just come back to this notion that it was neither sort of farcical enough or scary enough to warrant the attention almost that we're paying to it. But, you know, it is what it is. Have you Did you enjoy Nightcrawler, Night Stalker?
No, Nightcrawler. No, I didn't enjoy it, but I was impressed by it. You know, just in terms of like, it's, I mean, one of the things that's really shocking to me was just Nightcrawler, I think, is a genuinely a really beautiful looking film and, you know, captures this sort of nighttime aspect of LA and this sort of creepy feeling really well. And Velvet Buzzsaw looks like, you know, a not particularly good like horror TV show. Like it was like,
yeah,
it's like very brightly lit. I mean, some of that obviously is for like tone and like that most of it, a lot of it takes place in the daytime, but like it also just didn't look good. It wasn't a particularly
visually interesting movie. Yeah.
Visually, it just was not that interesting, except for like the scenes where you sit there and you try to think about like the art department having to create all this fake art. Other than that,
yeah,
like it's an interesting movie to look at, which I was sort of shocked by after how good Nightcrawler was in that respect. Right. You know, I had a lot of reservations about the story they were telling.
No, I was wondering if that might get into some of the limitations that a Netflix budget or a Netflix production imposes on things, right? So Nightcrawler was a big screen movie. It was an independent movie, but it was still made for distribution in cinemas. And I think that changes sort of the production values at least slightly. Because the canvas that you're working on is just larger when you're going to be projecting it on a bigger screen. Go ahead.
I think that's true to an extent. That certainly you have to imagine on some level that you're aware of that. But I mean, I also think that you compare this to something. I mean, that there are Netflix movies that made. I think this one. I'm looking. You know, according to Wikipedia, it had a budget of $21 million, which is
Jesus Christ.
You know, not a tiny budget. It's not a big budget. It's not a Marvel movie, but is a significant amount of money. And I think like there are other net, like Roma obviously is the obvious example of like, that is a movie that, you know, I mean, I think it's in some ways it's kind of a shame that I've only seen it on a TV. It is still playing in some theaters around New York. And I should see it on a big screen, but it is a beautiful, beautiful film.
Oh yeah, no. That movie is just gorgeous. Yeah.
Right. And it's shot for, you know, in a way that you can tell, like they're thinking about the big screen experience. So Netflix has the resources where if they wanted to, you know, they put quite a non-trivial amount of money into this movie. And I mean, I would also say in their defense, I mean, part of it is like, this feels like a movie that it's hard to imagine any studio giving him that much money to make this movie, because this is not a movie that I even in screenplay form, even with all the different, you know, relatively well-known actors involved, you don't look at it and think, well, this is going to make a ton of money. So I think even at a studio, I imagine if this was made at a studio, it would have been made for less money, not more money. You're talking about some like related but also slightly separate things, which is money, which Netflix does have, and also the question of, are you making it for the big screen, or are you making it for the TV, laptops, or, you know, watching on your iPhone or something?
Yeah, I mean, I this felt like a movie that wanted to be a B-grade movie with A-caliber actors that could only manage to sort of eke out a C production, if that makes sense.
I think that's right. And I think also that, like, it's just, I mean, we touched on this a little, but the biggest disappointment to me was how completely uninteresting the death scenes were. I mean, with one exception involving a work of art and an arm that we probably shouldn't get into, but at least unless we want to get into spoilers later. But other than that, like almost all the death scenes are incredibly straightforward, generally involve arms reaching out and grabbing a character and then like a smash cut to black. And you're just like, okay, well, that wasn't particularly frightening or interesting. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to give me nightmares, but I hope it doesn't sound sadistic, but like with a horror film, part of what you go for is, or what you're interested in is how you bring the horror in. And
right
here is just very generic, very dull and you know, even more disappointing to me than the fact that the satire didn't really land. I guess the satirical part I had lower expectations for, and also I'm not, you know, I'm obviously interested. I mean, I have some interest in visual art, but it's not a world that I've spent a lot of time in. So I would have been fine being like, okay, well, that part was made for somebody else, not me. But I wanted the horror movie aspects of it to be effective, and they were the opposite of that.
Yeah, I mean, you want something, you want something to execute on at least one of the two axes in which it's supposed to be operating. If you can't be funny, be scary. If you can't be scary, be funny. And this was neither. You're right, the death sequences were incredibly boring.
Right.
You know, like,
pedestrian.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny to talk about pedestrian death scenes, but but I mean, these things have been done well, and people can be inventive with them. This was like not even good recycling of older material that could have been done in a more shocking way. Anyway, I don't know. I feel like we've devoted more time than we should to this. If I had to issue a verdict on Velvet Buzzsaw, it would be go see Velvet Goldmine, which is an amazing movie.
Go see Nightcrawler even. I think that movie I have a lot of reservations about, but I think it's a million times more interesting than Velvet Buzzsaw. The one good thing I would say, but it is also a criticism, is I thought that the very beginnings when they're establishing the Rene Russo character, and she's like this gallery owner who used to be in a punk band, and she's had this sort of wild background, but has like become this very kind of corporate person. I thought that was interesting. And I thought there could have been interesting places that they could have taken that character. Also just because, you know, she's just such an amazing actress that just doesn't get featured enough. And but like, you know, once that setup happens, then she just becomes kind of like the greedy art gallery owner. And
No, I mean, it's like there were ways in which these characters could have been developed in a nuanced way to make them more interesting and relatable and make me care about them when they die even. But all of those attempts to establish that just sort of got erased or overwhelmed by the sort of plotting horror plot that they were establishing as well. And this sort of very superficial criticism of the art world. It also, like, the Velvet Buzzsaw of the name and the way that was tied into the movie and the ending was just so stupid. It was like unbelievably bad, unbelievably bad. Yeah, I don't know, man. I feel like I can't talk. I feel like I've spent more time talking about this movie now than anyone should spend watching.
So let me just very quickly remind people that if they enjoy the show, they can subscribe in Apple Podcasts. They can also subscribe in any other podcast app that they enjoy. They can also leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll be back next week. John, thank you so much for joining me.